Well, it's common in the language of the whole theological spectrum, in my experience, to hear the secular spoken of as if it were the opposition. This has become even more prevalent with the resurgence of religious fundamentalism. It's not uncommon to hear cries of protest from some religious circles when the secular state asserts itself in the shaping of our society through public policy. Most recently in Australia, secular political policy has prompted many in religious communities to complain of attacks by secularism on religious freedom. You'll be aware of those. Tonight, we welcome poet and theologian Padraig O'Toomer, who is going to invite us into a conversation about how we might understand secularity as a healthy spiritual condition and appreciate its role in the freedom of our whole community. Since 2014, Padraig has led Coromila, and I believe you've just announced that you're stepping aside from that position to concentrate on writing, which is good news for the world. Coromila is Ireland's oldest peace and reconciliation organisation, and Padraig has been at the centre of questions about how religion, politics and society relate in the quest for human flourishing and life-giving inclusive faith. Padraig has published several books, including readings from the Book of Exile, Sorry for Your Troubles, Daily Prayer with the Coromila Community and In the Shelter, and you can find details of those on his excellent website. We will hear from Padraig now, and when he's finished, we will have half an hour or so for questions and dialogue with Padraig, and that time will be facilitated through two microphones that will be controlled by myself and Angela, and I would ask you to formulate questions that are to the point and put in a form that Padraig is able to respond to. Don't try and grab the microphone because you'll get into a wrestle with either me or Angela. We're going to retain control of the microphones. So we can only sort of reach halfway up the steps. So if you have a question and you're in the middle somewhere there, just disturb everyone and come out and answer a question. Padraig, it really is a pleasure to have you here with us in Melbourne, and I invite you now to come and lead us in this conversation. Thank you.
Good evening. I join with us all in acknowledging the traditional owners and custodians of this land and their unceded presence here, and the need for continuing justice in the recognition of land ownership that has never been ceded. I am really honoured to be here. Thank you very much to Harriet Ziegler for the warm invitation to come and be part of the work through SCA, to Chris Turner for the invitation to be here at Stirling tonight, and to you for coming, because you've given up your evening, so I really appreciate that. I talk for a bit, and my favourite... dropping things. My favourite part is when we can have an opportunity to talk and to engage with each other. I'll tell some stories, read some poems, put forward a few thoughts, do a little bit of etymology, because no session is complete without a little bit of etymology. Probably speak a little bit in Irish, because as a person whose language was turned illegal, for me, part of the acknowledgement of country where I'm from is the continuing keeping alive of a language that has been threatened with murder through the colonial project, whether I'm in Ireland or not. And those are the kinds of things that we'll do. And then we'll have a conversation together, and I'm looking forward to that very much. I don't believe too much in singularities, so everything I say tonight, I'm interested in hearing how we hold it in tension with other things. And so please make space for yourself as you listen, and then jostle me a bit to make space for you as you listen. I know I have a soft voice. Has the increase in volume worked just there? Suddenly people are like, oh, he is talking. He's not moving his mouth around. Okay, we'll start off with a little poem. And that has gone a bit too loud. That's giving a bit of feedback. Thank you. There's a poem called An Gcuirt the Mór, translated into English, that means the Great Hunger. In 1845, a potato blight that had been travelling across Europe landed in Ireland. The population of Ireland at that stage was 8 million. By 1848, at the end of the Gcuirt the Mór, the Great Famine, the population of Ireland was 6 million. A million died, a million left. By 1880, the population was 4 million. Through continued starvation, as well as immigration. It is not and never by Irish people called the potato famine, because there is no such thing as a pure natural disaster famine. There is always policy. In 1780, I think I have the date right, the potato crop had also failed. But that was before the Act of Union, when Ireland had been unceremoniously brought into this new project called the United Kingdom, for which we never had a say. And Irish people were brought into this in 1801. But in 1780, the potato crop had failed. There was a little bit more self-determination in the Irish government at that stage. And the government had simply closed the ports, because there was enough beef and corn to feed everybody. In 1845, there was even more beef and corn, because Ireland really was the work factory for British beef and corn. And an appeal was made at the failure of the potato crop through a blight to Westminster to close the Irish ports to keep the food that was being made kept, and the answer was no. Many of the people who were loading ships that went off to feed the empire with beef and corn were themselves dying of starvation, and subsequently did die of starvation. Many of the soup kitchens that were set up would only serve people if they converted to Protestantism, which does give you a deep sense of the understanding about what Catholic and Protestant means in Ireland. It has nothing to do with the hereafter, everything to do with the here. So here's a little villanelle. Those of you who are interested in poetry will know what a villanelle is. It's a poem with a sequence of stanzas, and where the first and the third line keep on repeating throughout and throughout. Ultimately, villanelle is a form in poetry that adapts itself towards people with a certain level of obsessive compulsive disorder regarding questions of the past. And so that's us all, or it should be, because how will we learn about the present if we haven't looked to the past? There's a line, one of the repeated lines is, "My great-great-granddad was the only one who made it." This is true. My great-great-granddad was 11 in 1846, I believe, and he was the only one of his family who survived. Everybody else died. And another starving family took him in. And when he was 30, whatever that was, and about 20 years later, he went to get married, and the priest wouldn't let him get married because he hadn't made his confirmation. And that's the main point of this poem, as I'm going to tell you, but that it doesn't take part. But I'll read the villanelle for you. What this priest who said to my great-great-granddad that he couldn't get married because he hadn't made the requisite sacramental he hadn't gone through the requisite sacramentals, were what this priest was in need of was a little bit of secularism. Here's another story. I'm going to get the date wrong, 2012, I think, just before Christmas, there was a young girl, Kira Parks, her name was, she was 15. She was killed on the streets of Belfast because there was some really, really poor engineering, extraordinarily poor engineering in the city, where a bus going about 12, 15 miles an hour through a quasi-pedestrianised zone of the city had to make this really, really right-hand turn. And as a result, the front part of the bus was going exponentially faster. Engineers in here will understand what I mean by that, is the bus swung right around. And she was on the footpath, Kira was, and the front corner of the bus went over the footpath and knocked her down and killed her. 2 weeks before Christmas. And her form teacher in school was a friend of mine, and he called me up on a Sunday and he said to me, "I actually don't give a damn what you're doing tomorrow. Like, you can be doing something very important, but you have to cancel it. Because my class, her friends, who are full of grief, have decided that they want to write a letter to the bus driver, and I do not know what to do. And you have to cancel whatever you're doing, I don't care, and come in." And I really appreciated that forthright nature. And I actually did have an important meeting. And I told the important meeting, "I have to change the time," and they said, "Yeah, totally fine." People are very amenable, of course. Everybody knew what had happened. So I went in, this class of 15-year-olds were there, extraordinary people. I asked them to tell me about their friend. They told me some funny stories. They cried, they laughed. We laughed at their teacher, because I knew a few funny stories about him, so we all laughed at him as a convenient way to scapegoat somebody for the purpose of establishing a little bit of warmth. And and then I said, "What do you want to say to the bus driver?" Because everybody had heard that he was close to suicide. Fair enough. We can understand that and have sympathy for it. And they said, Kira always had this phrase where she said, wise up and be happy. And one of the girls in the class said, I have been a real bully. And Kira said to me one time, in the middle of being really bitter, when I was being horrible to somebody, Kira walked up to me and said, wise up and be happy. And she said, it stopped me in my tracks and it changed me. And so we want to say to him, you were in the wrong time, wrong place. We loved her and we hold nothing against you. And they, sure, that was the letter written. I just wrote it out and handed them their own notes back. And they, I was just the convenient idiot to be inside there. The excuse, really, that they could, the blank canvas. And then they sent this letter off. A month later, their teacher phoned me up and said, come back inside. We've gotten a reply. And he showed me the reply. And the reply was beautiful. It said, dear girls of class, whatever it was, 5F, or I don't know what the name of the class was, I want to thank you so much for your letter. You have no idea what this means. Your letter moved me so much, I even showed it to my wife. The Irish marriage is alive and well. And then he said, I will think about you every day for the rest of my life. And I believe that he told the truth there. I do not believe that was hyperbole. I believe he told the truth. What those 15-year-olds did was an experience of secularism. In a while, I'm going to define what I mean by secular, because what they did was secular. What that priest did in 1860s was in need of the secular. Here's another secular story. Jerry Reynolds was a Limerick man from County Limerick, and he grew up in a farming family. He had huge hands, bred to milk cattle, but he turned into a journalist and a priest, worked with the Order of Redemptorists, worked until he was 50 as a journalist with the Redemptorists. When he was 50, he moved to Belfast. And Jerry always was very anxious to reconcile all things. He had a great love for what it means to be a people of reconciliation. And he moved to Belfast in 1980. The Troubles were at a terrible stage. I mean, things had been going on for 12 years already. The Troubles didn't begin in 1968. Really, the Troubles had begun for 700 years. And the complex question of what does it mean that Britishness is present in Ireland, and how do we respond to that in a way that isn't as annihilationist as the colonising project? That's a long-term project, really, to understand. What do we do with Britishness and Irishness in the same shared space? And are borders appropriate or inappropriate when it comes to this question? So we were at that latest stage then in 1980. And Jerry really is credited by many paramilitary organizations as the quiet, big-handed, soft, gentle man who charmed them all to the table of negotiation, by getting to know them all. And one time he was invited to a meeting of a paramilitary organization, this took place in a home, but it was a home turned into a headquarters where every door had a big padlock on it, and there was a great show to welcome him in. Hello, Jerry. Padlock the door into the next door, padlock the door behind you, up the steps to the upstairs, padlock the door at the bottom of the stairs, the whole lot. It was all a big show of force. And he got into this upstairs room where there was a bunch of boys sitting around a table, a member of this paramilitary organization. They said to him, sit you over in the corner there and you can listen but not talk. This is this whole putting him in his place, a really interesting performance of masculinities. And they sat down. Jerry was unperturbed. Sure, he'd grown up with bulls around the place. And he sat down at the corner. One of them said, right, we'll start. And Jerry said from the corner, excuse me, boys, I believe before we start, it would be appropriate to begin with a prayer. And he looked at him and he said, mercy and justice have embraced. Truth and peace have kissed. Psalm 85. That is a secular experience. And this is the kind of secularism that might save us. Secular comes from an old and lovely Latin word meaning saeculum, meaning in the world, worldly, present to the generational times. Siècle, for any of you who speak French, means from age to age. And that siècle comes from the old Latin word meaning that turns into secular. It means of the age right now, in the world, present to the ordinary thing. A secular approach toward belief is tempered by the understanding that belief in anything is always proportioned to the available evidence. This goes to say that the secular infused approach to life is always open to change, engagement, encounter, and adaptability. Or, in the words of Jesus of Nazareth, repentance. because something is near. The world is near. A different world than you've thought. The secular project is a profoundly important project, not something to be frightened of. The secular is a thing that makes space for beliefs as they engage with the facts of the world as we see them. It is a meeting place, and as such requires people with different belief systems to engage with each other. I do not hold with the idea that the secular space is an anti-religious space. In its imagination, the secular is a profoundly democratic project, a space where people with all kinds of different points of view can engage in a project of meeting that seeks to deliberately undo supremacist and dominant styles of power, and instead seeks to engage in a project that meets the world right here, right now. That requires courage and truth and belief in all kinds of things, and the capacity for those beliefs to have a serious, intelligent conversation without freaking out. It's also called grow the hell up. A religiously informed opinion is not excluded from the secular discussion, but notably, it certainly isn't privileged either. It is not persecution to engage with something that says, I think that's made up. That's just a damn good argument. And if you can't respond to that with intelligence, well, then that's not persecution. That's a lack of education. In the Catholic context, and other people might know more about other contexts, we regularly hear about secular clergy. And from the Catholic point of view, a priest who's called a secular priest is simply a priest who doesn't live in a monastery. That's it, out in the world, living there in a house next door, with a mortgage, with a loan on his car, and all the complications that comes with the kind of obsession about a masculinity within the... I'm not defending the structures of the priesthood, but secular priests have been a thing. It's a long-standing thing to have a thing called a secular priest. And a secular priest is different from a religious priest, which isn't to say that secular priests are irreligious. It just means they don't live in a religious community. They don't live in a monastery. Now, a couple of careful things to say about that is that the world is present in the monastery also. Any of you who've been, ever lived in a monastery, or visited a monastery will know that it's a sophisticated, complicated, and brilliant life in a monastery or in a convent where the world is fully present there. It's kind of hard to escape from the world because we carry it in us. I do think there has been a growth in a certain series of fundamentalisms. I'm going to touch on a few, but they're mild in terms of their analysis, because we could be here all night to talk about these things, but we might want to talk about them later on. I do think when it comes to certain political powers, there has been a growth in a boorishness that has been accepted in certain fields of public discourse. The Trump phenomenon will not end with the Trump phenomenon. The Trump phenomenon is really the face of something which is objecting to a certain call to a level of accountability. And Trump, unfortunately, is nothing new. And also, things didn't get bad when Trump came in. And lots of people were like, we thought the world was progressing, but gosh, since Trump, it's not. Other people would be like, right, what little luxury have you been living in? Because for many people, the world hasn't been progressing. There is a boorishness regarding power, accountability, masculinities, and language that's happening through the Trump phenomenon. This is entirely my opinion. You can think what you want about this, but as far as the Irish see it, Brexit is a fixation and an ideology about the past and a memory of an England that never was there. It's the memory of an England where the poor were happy and delighted to be part of it. When the poor were poor in the old England, they were upset then too, rather than delighted about the fact that being kept poor by self-entitled people who live in the home counties. The Brexit project similarly has a fantasy about the purity of a population. And purity is not limited to the Book of Leviticus alone. Purity is not limited to certain forms of exclusive Christianities or any form of religion. You find purities in all kinds of contexts. And that is a worrying growth. Bizarrely, I do think that J.K. Rowling was onto something when she wrote in her Harry Potter series this kind of subtext regarding the question about mudbloods, because in a certain sense she was writing into children's literature something important about this idea about who do we consider to be pure and how do we accept purities in our society. And there is a growth of a variety of forms of a new Puritanism that is deeply worrying. I want to point out to the thing that has already been acknowledged by Chris and Harriet and by what's been saying in terms of colonization, colonialism. In a world where we hear about religious fundamentalism as if it's a new thing, I think it's really important to spend a little bit of more time thinking about the last 400 years of religious fundamentalism through the colonial project. At the close of World War I, colonial powers occupied or had some control over 9/10 of the world. Colonialism comes from an old French word, colon, meaning field. How many fields make up 9/10 of the world's landmass? That is an extraordinary statistic. And when you think that most of these, not all, but most of these were by English, French, Spanish, Portuguese, and Belgian overlords who perpetuated systematic genocides, dehumanization policies, stood over famines, starved populations to keep them compliant, engaged in divide and conquer tactics, and in their language, civilized the uncivilized without ever having considered to civilize themselves, all under the protective guise of Christianity. Contemporary religious fundamentalism hasn't begun to compete with the Christian projects of the latter part of the second millennium of the Common Era. And we need to recognize the way within which those who are shocked by the way some religious fundamentalisms might be appearing now have perhaps not paid attention to the very systems that have given us the luxuries that we enjoy so much. There are, outside of the religious tradition that I am from, I'm Catholic on Tuesdays, outside of that, there are other religious fundamentalisms that you find in other parts of the world, Hindu religious fundamentalisms, Muslim religious fundamentalisms, Sikh religious fundamentalisms, Buddhist religious fundamentalisms, which engage in power and murder and exploitation. They're absolutely there. I do practice strongly the idea that I can be the most critical about my own family, about my own self, and about my own people when it comes to my religious belongings. So I'm going to particularly limit my considerations of religious fundamentalism to Christianity. And that's my choice, but you can make whatever associations about that that you wish. Another example, and this is an important example, about certain fundamentalisms that are addicted to a certain kind of purity, is the project of either murdering or converting gay people to some other form of sexual orientation. There is an obsession, an addictive obsession, I think, in certain forms of gendered identities to think about A, the causation, and B, the cure, and C, the consequences of having LGBT people in public. As if when LGBT people, like myself, when we get power, that we might in turn turn the power and be as terrible to heterosexuals as heterosexuals have been to us. We won't, but we understand your fear because it's been caused by you. And it's always frightening to face the consequence of the very thing that has grown like a spawn in yourself. It's important to recognize in fundamentalisms that things don't go in straight lines. Time isn't linear, time is circular. Time keeps on repeating once again. In the Brexit project, in 2020, we will be marking the centenary of the drawing of the border that delineated the north from the south of Ireland. And in 2021, we will be marking the centenary of the enacting of the partition of Ireland. These are difficult, difficult centenaries anyway, without once again facing the consequence in Ireland of people on the island of Britain having made a decision that's impacting on the question of our border. History has a horrible way of repeating itself and coming back. And that is something to pay attention to, I think, when it comes to the question about secularism. How is it that we can, in all of these projects, in every single one of them, think about what does it mean to meet the world? Because they each have at their heart an addictive, violent purity system purity system about what a real man is, purity system about what a real citizen is, purity system about what a real politician is, purity system about what a real power is. They're all addicted to a very singular purity system that is convinced that in isolation and the luxuriating of isolation into a certain kind of power and giving that power influence, that that will be a solving. And they are threatened by the possibility of A, sharing power, or B, taking seriously somebody who embodies the exact opposite of the thing they say will work. There is a strange form of isolationism. So in a certain sense, I think that very, very anti-religious political groups are in need of secularizing, because the world has lots of religious people in it. And to be engaged in a secular project for people who are hateful towards religious people needs to meet the religions of the world, engage there. So secularism is always the engagement to meeting with the facts of reality on the ground, and the facts of reality on the ground are always going to be plural, are always going to be interesting like that. I should say, I suppose I want to address, there are some new purities that are out there. I mentioned some of those. Some new purities are more attracted to the performance of purities rather than the practice of them. Honestly, if somebody says LGBTQ, LGBTQI, LGB, or if somebody even says the gays, if their practices are right, I won't lose too much sleep as to whether they've gotten the acronym right or wrong. Honestly, maybe you'd go, I hear just a quick piece of information, like your grand. But there are some people who have set themselves up. Some allies, self-defined allies, are more exhausting to me than homophobes. And by this, I am not saying anything about PC culture. Here's a little bit of alliteration for you. I was a fear-filled, fired faggot. And I'm very glad to not live in a world where that is too possible anymore. Fear-filled, fired, faggot. Language needs to be changed. I'm very glad to live in a situation where if somebody uses that word, I'm glad to use it about myself, but if somebody uses that word, that probably somebody would say, you know, you can't, because language is where violence begins. I'm very glad not to be in a situation where I can be fired too much, although that definitely does happen around the place. If a PC culture, politically correct culture, is correct, I'm delighted that it saved me. And if it causes me to have to pay attention to casual violences of languages that don't bother me, I'm thrilled to make the adjustment, because PC culture has saved me and given me an imagination of something that might help me to live into a world that's safe and not violent. So I am all for PC. We can have a conversation about that. I'm not all for stupidity, but I am all for PC. This is still the introduction. I joke. I'm only going to talk for another 20 minutes. I'll read you another poem. Here is a poem about a secular experience. There's two poems. Here's one of them. This poem is called Not Yet. There was a bunch of us sitting around a table a few years ago, and there was a young guy there who was under 30. This is back at home, a young guy, and he said something about the Troubles, which is the word used particularly from 1968 to 1998 to mark that period of violence in Northern Ireland. 3,600 people murdered, 80,000 people injured, 500,000 people affected directly by bereavement or being associated with somebody who was injured in a population of 1.5 million, which means one out of every three was linked in a certain sense. So that's a tiny population with an enormous impact. And so this is a few years ago. Our peace agreement, which is the beginning of peace, not the achievement of peace, be very aware of that. Peace achievements take as long to enact as they took to escalate. And we've been going at it 700 years, so you'll be hearing about Ireland for a long time. So this fella, a few years ago, 15 years easily after the peace agreement, said something about the Troubles, and he was under 30. And there was a person who was very important, a peace man, very, very significantly involved in the negotiations of peace. And he said nonchalantly around the table to this young fella, "You're too young to know about the Troubles." And then the following happened. It's called Not Yet. "You're too young to know about the Troubles," the peace man said. And the young man said, father shot dead. Mother fell apart. Brother fell into himself. Other brother sent to live with others. And me, I smothered everything. I was farmed around. And now, years later, we have found ourselves back beneath a shared and troubled ceiling. Not yet. No one's too young to know about the troubles. That was a secular experience for the peace man. Not because it opened to religion or it closed religion, but it gave his ideological point of view regarding the question of the troubles. It encountered that with the reality of the world right in front of him. Siècle de siècle, the generational encounter with the world that as it is right now. There was this young fella there whose family had been obliterated by his father having been shot dead deliberately. His father was targeted. His father was considered to be a legitimate target and so was shot as a result of that. Here's another little poem about legitimate targets. I think I know it by heart, but I'll have it there in case I forget it. I was in a room for 3 days. There were in the room people from North and South, people from British identities, Irish identities, people involved in politics, people involved in the security services, the army and the police, people involved in paramilitary organizations, people involved in peacemaking initiatives. Just to add into the mix, we also had people from across the whole religious spectrum in Israel and Palestine there too, from across religious perspective and all the many political perspectives that were associated there. And the experiment was, in 3 days, can we stay together? Can we find some way of talking that isn't about saying who's on one side or who's on the other, but also isn't about being saccharine and say, haven't we had a lovely time and isn't it all sweet? Can we argue well? Can we find language to talk about the things that deeply divide us in a way we can hear each other and where we don't begin to say, well, you're just an idiot and shut down, where the opportunity for disagreement is seen as the invitation into the secular project of co-creating a democracy together, where we have in the room all the kinds of worlds that typically would not be seen to collide with each other and stay with each other in a space of hospitality. That's what peace looks like. Peace is a damn hard argument rather than daisy chains. Anyway, some of the people in the room had a conversation about the conjugation of a sentence that involved the word murder, because somebody in the room said, look, I've never gotten over murdering the person I murdered. This person was from a particular paramilitary organization. Somebody else in the room said, you need to stop using that word murder. You didn't murder somebody. They were from the same paramilitary organization. They said, you didn't murder somebody. Lives were lost. A very interesting, I don't know that we have in English. In Irish, you'd call that the briher ser, the free verb. You're conjugating a sentence there without any subject, really, to it. Lives were lost, you know, arbitrarily. They just lost, you know, not a gun. Somebody else said, I took a life. I didn't murder, I took. Somebody else said, I was under orders. Somebody else said, I only ever shot at legitimate targets. And then somebody else said, well, I guess that made me one of your legitimate targets. And because these are people who know terrible things about the world, everybody erupted into laughter. Because when you get used to these things, that's actually hilarious. It shouldn't be, but this is the kind of terrible thing that people have to. You have to find humor. And it was laughter at how funny it was, and how brave it was, and how true it was. And suddenly we were left as two people looking at each other, where one had defined the other as a legitimate target, because indeed a gun had been held to their head by a member of their organization. So here's a little poem about that. And that's a secular experience, because worldviews were clashing with worldviews, and somebody had the bravery to say, I guess that was me then. A secular experience. Welcome to the world. Here's a little poem. When I was a child, I learned to count to 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But these days I've been counting lives. So I count one life, one life, one life, one life, one life. Because each time is the first time that that life has been taken. Legitimate target has 16 letters, and one long, abominable space between two dehumanizing words. What we're looking for in the secular project is a capacity to deliberately say, we need to bump into another world. There's too many like us around this table. We're talking about people as if they don't exist, or as if they'll be glad that we're talking about them rather than to them. It's a deliberate flexing of a civic democracy that doesn't hate religion, but it also sees beyond it or sees into it. It doesn't hate your own political party, but it sees beyond it and it sees into it. It doesn't hate your country, it doesn't hate your gender, it doesn't hate your sexual orientation, it doesn't hate your race, but it sees beyond it and says, we have to be better than just a bunch of us doing this project, as if the bunch of us are the best ones to do it for everybody. That is what the secular project is, the deliberate recognition that worlds need to meet worlds. I want to think a little bit about some of the things that are going on in the mindset of separatist fundamentalisms. And I use the word separatist deliberately there, because they are isolationist, separatist. They might absolutely be religious. They might absolutely be political or gender-oriented or race-oriented or economic-oriented, etc. One of the things that's going on is a powerful group belonging, and that is as appealing as it is sectarian. It is an extraordinary thing to belong to an us. If you ever work with a class of 8-year-olds, I think things are gotten a little bit better now, but maybe not. It used to almost be inevitable that there probably was, in a class of 30 8-year-olds, there probably was one or two that were fairly hated. I remember in our class that there was one or two that fairly hated. I was absolutely the bottom of the barrel myself, but I wasn't at that level. And I remember one day the two most hated fellas in our class were out, and somebody said to the teacher, "Teacher, we're going to have a great day today," and he mentioned the two fellas are out, off sick. Who taught us that? Who taught us? There was such an extraordinary sense of belonging that day. The group were together. People who ordinarily bullied each other didn't. We played together. It was amazing. A little violent sense of belonging. Sectarianism is belonging gone bad. And belonging is very appealing, but we need to have an understanding that belonging needs always to be checked. Is our belonging based over and against somebody else? Because when belonging works for some, it really feels fantastic when it works for you. It promises a lovely form of certainty, and it provides extraordinary community in practice, that kind of limited belonging. It really feels fantastic when you're inside. Until you begin to think, well, maybe I'm not quite so inside. Maybe I'm a little bit of a mudblood. Whatever it is that's going to highlight and suddenly cause a bit of a fracture. And then there'll be a new pure at the heart of it. Sectarianism also, separatist fundamentalisms, provide a deep sense of story. A text, perhaps, a text of a religion, a text of a country, a text of a story of belonging in which we can locate our story and our struggle. And that is an extraordinary thing. We are narrative-oriented people. It's a great thing to have a story about ourselves, but we need always to question our story. I read out the poem on Gert the Moor at the beginning there. In the published version of that, when it comes out, it has a line from a guy, John Mitchell. He was a Derry clergyman, Protestant clergyman, and he has this line, "The Lord Almighty sent the blight, but the English created the famine." That's true. He said those words, and he is kind of loved in Ireland for putting his point on the fit out there. He was exiled by the British to Van Diemen's Land, and he was there, Tasmania, for 6 years. He escaped. He was meant to be there much longer, made his way to the United States, set up a newspaper in the southern part of the United States, a newspaper that was absolutely and utterly committed to the continuation and the propagation and the deepening of the slavery project. Now, Irish people love to remember John Mitchell's words about the English, but we love to forget John Mitchell's words about slavery, because we like to think that when we went away, we were fantastic in Jamaica, in America, in Canada, in Australia, in New Zealand. We weren't racist at all. We were loved. Absolutely not true. The overwhelming evidence is that when Irish people went away, Irish people having suffered terribly at the hands of the colonial project, we enacted the colonial projects, maybe as lower members on the rung, fine, but certainly on the run. We discovered something white about us that we had not known about before. And that was to our convenience. We need to tell that story as Irish people when it comes to civic reckoning. Because Irish people are now saying, oh gosh, in the last 20 years there's been this great influx of people from all around the world, and Irish people are suddenly beginning to need to have conversations about race. That is such a denial of the 18th century. We were terrible. It was an Irish man who helped to oversee the displacement of the Choctaw Nation. Choctaw Nation were taken from the eastern seaboard of the United States, forcibly marched to what is now called Oklahoma, and they had been there and for 15 years at this stage, and he was enacting displacement government policies. Irish guy from County Kerry. And he told members of the Choctaw Nation in 1847 that his home country was going through a famine. The Choctaw Nation organized a fundraiser. $710, apparently the equivalent of $1 million now, 1847, to be sent for the relief of the famine poor. And they heard about that from some Irish fella who was displacing them from their own land, he himself who had been displaced through hunger and starvation from his own land. Like, that is a shameful story. And we'd love to say, he was just the one bad apple in the barrel. The barrel was bad with a couple of good ones, rather than the barrel being good with a couple of bad ones. There is a recognition about racism that Irish people need to wake up to. There's nothing new about racism in the Irish project. What we need to do is to find ways to meet the world and find ways to recognize that some of our belongings, some of the way that Irish people love to blame the British for the past, actually means that we don't face our own racist past. And we need to deliberately upset that a little bit, not wait for somebody to come along and challenge it. And I think this is a secular project to bump us up into the worlds. You have some handouts So this thing here called The Scale of Sectarian Danger is the summary done by John Hatch of a chapter from a book called Moving Beyond Sectarianism. I think, is that gone off now totally? So it's off totally now. My voice will last about 5 minutes before it loses. I keep talking. It's from this book called The Scale of Sectarian Danger, or some of the book called Moving Beyond Sectarianism. And in chapter 11 of that book, Lichty and Clegg, the two scholars behind the book, have done this terrible scale, really, of group belonging. And they say that the top one is we are different, we believe differently. And that number 11, you see that down there as you are demonic. Okay? And they say that the further on down you go, the more likelihood it is that sectarian belonging might begin to creep in. Okay? It isn't to say that all of these are sectarian statements at all. We're different, we believe differently. Like, I don't know too many marriages that could survive without that kind of statement. We are right, that's fair enough too. There's plenty of times we believe you're right, do you know? Do you support Geelong or Collingwood? I don't know what that means, actually. I know what those things are. I do know a couple in Adelaide, though, where one supports Port Power and the other supports the Crows. Is that right? Yeah, that is testament to the capacity of love. So, apparently. We're right and you are wrong. That's okay, too. I mean, genuinely, you can perfectly hold that statement without being sectarian or violent. Our way is right, but other ways are, or at least maybe, equally valid. Okay, fair enough. Milk in the cup before the tea goes in, milk in the cup after the tea goes in. I'm being silly there, but there's various things. Like, we can find ways to participate well together. Our way is right, and we're not really interested in other ways of doing things, but we make no judgment about them one way or the other. Our way is right and better than yours, although your way has some merit. You can begin to see some of these things there, but it's really important. Our way is right, your way is wrong. Okay. We are right and you are wrong, but in this one particular area, so we don't emphasize this, because you and I have a great deal in common. So there's that also is a very wise statement about certain things. You can skip on down a little bit there. Look at Jay. We have chosen to say you are wrong because it is our duty to denounce error and expose injustice. Now, it's easy to feel awful about that, but it's also important to say, do you know what? I'm there sometimes. Like when people say that LGBT people should be exorcised, I will choose to say they are wrong because it's my duty to denounce error and expose injustice. I'm really happy to exist in J there on certain issues, okay? We need to stress that you are wrong because we would be uncertain about our rightness if we were uncertain about your wrongness. What an extraordinary statement there. And that is, for me, one of the most chilling spaces of belonging here, because that is a way that is threatened by the idea of meeting somebody who represents the thing you claim to be against. So even the encounter is a threat. Look on to 4, you are less adequate about what we are. Number 5, you are not what you say you are. 6, we are, in fact, what you say you are. I'm a real patriot. You're actually not a patriot at all, in a place where patriotism might be important, or these various things. I am not a true follower of our religion. Though you're not a true follower of your religion, I am a more faithful follower of religion. And then on down to, you're less than human, you're evil, you're demonic. This is a really interesting scale to look at this and to look at where are we and where do we need to get to. And actually, with certain things, I don't want to get up to a kind of saccharine, oh, isn't it all lovely, we're different, we believe differently. There's certain things that I want to say, I think that's wrong. But we need to do it in a way that is secular, encountering people from different points of view, encountering people from the same belonging as me, encountering people who come from a different world, and where we're able to say, let's do this together, where I'm not going to say, you're not human. But in having these discussions, I'm not going to go further down. I might just go, we need to stay right here and do this well, do this as an engagement of civic argument in a secular way. Sometimes that's two co-religionists, sometimes it's two Christians meeting with each other, having that argument. One of the things that's happening back home, and that is I think happening elsewhere too, is that it's less now people saying in public, do you think Catholics can be actual Christians? In the 1990s, people used to say that to me. They used to say, this is Padraig. He's a Catholic and a Christian. That exciting for us all. They didn't know I was gay then. That was very exciting. But now people tend to say things like, my friend who's a conservative, but he's lovely. Or this is this person who's a liberal, but they actually do love Jesus, or Allah, or whatever, do you know. We have these ways within which this liberal conservative thing has become really accepted as this barrier that we think there's only the exceptions that go across it. And how can we have these arguments well? Not where we're pretending a saccharine kind of shared opinion. No, where we're engaging in projects that are not saying, you are immoral because you belong to that group. How can you call yourself an intelligent human being if you vote X? Or all these ways that we have going on. You hear these kinds of sectarian statements that are happening that are deeply in need of a secularizing, because they are deeply in need of bumping up in a serious way with something that thinks differently and having an engaged, honest conversation where there is the courage open to change present there. Ultimately, I suppose I am making an argument for incarnational theology. We're just calling it secularism. Both are the same to me. As I read the Gospels, I don't see that the project of God, if you follow the Christian tradition, the project of God in becoming human through this person, Jesus of Nazareth, was an extraordinary secularizing of God to bump up to the world and to find out what the hell is going to happen. It's an interesting thing, and let's see what unfolds. On the back of the scale of sectarian danger, there's another poem. We are moving towards the end, but I'll take another 5 minutes, if that's okay. This poem, I'll tell you about the poet before we read the poem briefly. This poem is called Concerning the Prayer I Cannot Make by Jane Mead, published in 1996 by Sarabend Books. It's from a book that I bought, A, because a hot guy came up to me and told me he thought I'd like it, so I'm doing fine. And B, because the title, I wrote down the title, The Lord and the General Din of the World. It's a great title of a book. And Jane Mead is a poet who has the capacity to observe everyday reality. And at the time, the narrative of the family that she's in, herself and her two parents, they were all living with severe forms of drug dependency. There's a chilling line, a horrible line in the book, where the three of them are sitting around a table wondering in whose dark anus we have hid the stash. They can't remember because they've been hiding their stash drugs in each other's bodies for so long they've forgotten who's holding it these days. And it's the slow unraveling of all of that. It's the sentencing of her father. And it is, at its heart, a book of prayer. It won an enormous award, was given this extraordinary introduction. And she has continued to write amazing books. Her most recent one is called World of Made and Unmade, about the death of her mother, which is overwhelming and filled with blank space. She's very inventive when it comes to form. This is the opening poem in the opening book that introduced her to the world. And I think it is an extraordinarily secular poem because it is a prayer desperately in contact with the world and seeking to create some kind of fusion that might save. Jesus, I am cruelly lonely and I do not know what I have done, nor do I suspect you will answer me. And what is more, I have spent these bare months bargaining with my soul as if I could make her promise to love me, when now it seems that what I meant when I said soul was that the river reflects the railway bridge, just as the sky says it should. It speaks that language. I do not know who you are. I come here every day to be beneath this bridge, to sit beside this river, so I must have seen the way the clouds just slide under the rusty arch without snagging on the bolts, how they are borne along on the dark water. I must have noticed their fluent speed, and also how that tattered blue t-shirt remains snagged on the crown of the mostly sunk dead tree, despite the current's constant pulling. Yes, somewhere in their mind there must be the image of a sky blue t-shirt caught, and the white islands of ice flying by, and the light clouds flying slowly under the bridge, though today the river's fully melted. I must have seen, but I did not see. I am not equal to my longing. Somewhere there should be a place the exact shape of my emptiness. There should be a place responsible for taking one back. The river, of course, has no mercy. It just lifts the dead fish toward the sea. Of course, what I meant when I said soul was that there should be a place. On the far bank of the warehouse, lights blink red and green, and all the yellow machines with their rusted scoops and lift sit under a thin layer of sunny frost. And look on my own palm there, slowly rocking. It is my pale palm, palm where a black pebble is turning and turning. Listen, all you bare trees, burrs, brambles, pile of twigs, red and green lights flashing, muddy bottle shards, shoe half buried. Listen, listen, I am holy. It is, I think, one of the most extraordinary pieces of poetry I've ever read. To look at some of the architecture of it is to pay attention to the b, the plosive sounds, the b and the p. She's observing all of this decay around her. Yellow machines, broken window, t-shirt, mostly sunk dead half tree, the river lifting the dead fish toward the sea. The light nonetheless, the frost, the glinting, this interaction between a kind of a detritus of human industry. And she is there. At times it seems like she's the only one breathing. And yet she is there defiantly calling out for the secular experience that in the waste of herself that she can declare that she is holy. That is a secular experience because the world of isolationism that she finds herself in is a world that is denying God and is in need of the secular experience of acknowledging the holiness of the human person. It is overwhelmingly brilliant in terms of its insight to the human condition. And the book continues to be as brilliant as that. I'm not paid by Sarah Bend Books, but I should be. I'll finish by saying a couple of things which really I've been saying the whole time. The opposite of secularism isn't religion. It's ideological seclusion. Religion and secularism are not opposing forces. We don't need people to become less religious. We need people to meet each other in the world. We need people of all religious convictions to deepen their religious conviction by seeking out secular experiences that convert us towards each other, with each other, with the possibility of serious encounter and change. Secularism, defined as space for non-religiosity, is just going to make religious people feel persecuted. And there is little that religious people like more than a little bit of abstract persecution, let me tell you. We could talk all night about that. We need people to embrace the necessity of secular experience and practice, the creativity and risk that is involved in saying, look at all of us around the table, aren't we a pretty bunch of the same thing? And then to say, what are we going to do about it? Not wait until somebody shouts out about it, but to say, let's flex this muscle. Are we big enough to do more? I'll repeat that I think this is a profoundly incarnational project. And at the heart of all religious traditions, I think there is always the call into the human person. There is always some indication that to pay attention to the human person is perhaps to pay attention to the source of the human project, which, according to different traditions, is defined differently, but ultimately is something sacred that Jane Mead is calling us to, the holy. Not saying that that's all easy. Certainly this experience is not easy. But it is calling us towards a gaze of respect towards each other, and that is difficult. It is made easy if we seclude ourselves away, but that is always going to make life difficult for people for whom life is already perhaps too difficult. Thank you very much.